We're going to get going. It's not a long session. It's going to go, it's scheduled for 50 minutes. We'll go maybe like 40 some. We'll have some time for questions. I'll keep talking until it's time to stop, I guess. This talk is titled, what do they call it? Rav Moshe Feinstein, Posek of America. Okay, so let us begin. Rav Moshe Feinstein, 1895 to 1986. When we come to Rav Moshe Feinstein, we're dealing with the most important posek in the United States from the late 1950s until his death in 1986. I wish the shtender was higher. Can it go up? I don't think so. Do you know if there's a bigger shtender? If someone could find it, that'll be good. I hate looking down. I like to look at you. And it's just in the corner. Oh, yes. Let me roll this over here. This is perfect. Okay, thank you. But I do have to bring it over here because I need to be near the microphone as it is taped. So let's, what do we send? Let me just move this. Okay. Okay. In the last 15 years or so of his life, he was regarded as the greatest posek in the world. That is, if you speak to people who were in yeshivas, let's say in the 1970s, they'll tell you that he was the world's premier posek. And he was a legendary figure. When I was in yeshiva, for example, I was told by my Rebbe that he never read a newspaper because he didn't want a secular newspaper, New York Times, let's say, because he didn't want his psak to be influenced by outside factors. Now, what's interesting, it shows you how one person's praise is another person's criticism. At that time, I was working, if anyone here is from the New York area, you might remember a hotel called Simcha by the Sea. In Staten Island, New York, there was a hotel, Simcha by the Sea. I used to go there every Shabbos. I was a waiter there. And they'd have Sheva Brachas and everything. Rav Aaron Cutler's widow used to come because the guy who ran it was from Lakewood. His daughter, Rebbetzin Schwartzman, came. I was her waiter every week. They were there and many other Simchas. In fact, it's unique. I don't know if you can have it today. This is a hotel. I worked there Pesach, Sukkot. Hundreds of people would come. It never had a hashgacha. And everyone trusted the owner, who was a Lakewood guy. One Shabbos, I'm told that next week Rav Moshe Feinstein's going to be there because his granddaughter, Sheva Brachos. So we come very excited. He wasn't there, but his son, the rest of the family was there, including Rav Reuven Feinstein. And I spent a lot of the time talking to him. And then I said to him, this was in 1984, I was a senior in high school, I said, is it true that your father never reads a newspaper so that his halachic decision-making is not influenced by the outside world? And he looked at me, and this is what he said, and we even have a witness, if you don't believe me. He said, you think my father is ignorant? And he said, of course he reads. He reads the paper every day. So in other words, what I was told by my Rebbe to build him up as such a great tzaddik, Rav Reuven Feinstein thought it was an insult that I would say he doesn't read every newspaper. And then he went on explaining he's a citizen even. He knows English, he's et cetera. Rabbi Tendler described how when he was on his the last days, when he was in the hospital, you couldn't get the New York Times out of his hands because he wanted to know what was going on. His dominance as the world's premier posek might even begin with the 1960s. Before this, in America, the premier posek, I think you have to say, was Rabbi Henkin, who, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, lived on the Lower East Side. But Rav Henkin, even at his peak, was never regarded as like a national posek Rav Moshe. I mean, there's no sense that people living in Los Angeles or Chicago felt that they would have to ask Rav Henkin. They had their own local post scheme. Rav Moshe, however, becomes, as we'll see, the posek for the entire country, and then the world, and his tshuvot, his response, reflect that. Now, this doesn't mean that people accepted him like he was the Pope or anything like that. There are many who argued with him in the U.S. and in Israel, and also in the U.S. We're going to discuss some of these great arguments. In fact, there was even a volume published. It looks just like the Igros Moshe. It was published by the same publisher called Ma'anel Igrot. Ma'anel Igros. I don't know if any Sfarim stores ever carried it. I got my copy directly from the publisher. The author is Rav Yom Tov Schwartz. I guess probably he's Hungarian, or certainly he tilts to that way. Page after page, he rejects Rav Moshe. He attacks him for being too lenient, when he should be strict, being strict when he's lenient. He calls him an ignoramus. I mean, this is page after page. We know in the hagiography and Ramosha, we're told that during the printing, the printer realized what this is, and he wanted to stop, but then he was going to lose all this money. He called Ramosha, and Ramosha said, you know, let him print it. Who cares? And the book was never carried by any Sfarim stores, although Rav Avadi Yosef cites it. He says he should be respectful, though, to Rav Moshe, but he makes some good arguments. This rabbi, by the way, is also the author of an unbelievable book that appeared in English, published by Urim Press. It's called With Eyes to See, which I highly recommend. This is a very sensitive discussion of what the Holocaust did to the Jewish world. I mean, he sees the Holocaust as having distorted the Jewish mindset of those who survived and distorted traditional Judaism. And he attacks the Haredi world for the way they treat the non-religious. I mean, it's unbelievable that someone who could write such a sensitive and thoughtful work could also be the author of this vicious and disrespectful attack on the Posek Hador. Okay, now I just called Ramosha the Posek Ador, the Posek of the generation. I should clarify that I'm speaking of the great majority of the Torah world, but not the whole Torah world, because after all, the Sfaradim never regarded him as the Posek. They had their own post scheme. And then what about Hasidim? The Hasidim never regarded him as the greatest Posek Tangerin. So let's say the Lithuanian Torah world. That's who regarded him as such. In fact, just to give you a sense of this, I'm sure many of you know that Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, had a number of leniencies. Well, a friend of mine who grew up in Williamsburg, he's now the rabbi in Budapest, Rav Baruch Oberlander, the Chabad rabbi, but he grew up in a group called Papa. He told me that growing up, they thought Rav Moshe Feinstein was like the Posek for the modern Orthodox, you know, with all these pasukim, because in the Satmar type Papa world, they never accepted him. Okay, let me give you some biographical details of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He's born in 1895 in a Russian town, White Russia, called Uzhda. His father was Rav of the city. Rav Moshe is the first cousin of Rav Soloveitchik's mother. When he was around 13, he went to study in Slutsk, the big yeshiva in Slutsk. He stayed for around 5 months, and then he left and he followed his Rebbe, Narav Vissarion Meltzer, Rav Pesach Pruskin, to another city where he stayed 5 years. When he was around 20, he came back to be Rav of the city of his father's city. His father was no longer the Rav, and this position allowed him to avoid the draft, and he was hired. In a couple of years, World War I would be over, and now you have new countries, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and this is great for Jewish life. You're not living under the Tsar. But for Jews living in Russia, and you had enormous numbers, however bad the Tsar was, and the Tsar was bad, Jews lived under a Pale of Settlement, there was persecution, compared to communism, it was nothing. Jews lived for hundreds of years, you know, under the Tsar, and yet they were able to achieve great things, Torah institution, etc. Communism in 20, 30 years basically destroyed Jewish life. Rav Moshe was one of the rabbis and stuck behind the Iron Curtain, what would soon be called the Iron Curtain in communist Russia. Now, in the early years of communist Russia, Judaism was still possible. I mean, you had shuls, you know, the communists were focused on fighting the civil war they had with the whites, and they didn't focus on the Jews. By 1920, he was Rav of a Russian city called Luban. And we have Torah writings from Moshe throughout this period. He wrote Chidushim, he wrote Responsa, but then the persecution starts increasing. And the persecution, by the way, was led by Jewish members of the Communist Party. They were really the ones responsible for this. And throughout Russia, shuls were closed down. They closed the mikvahs. I mean, how'd they do this? According to the Russian Communist Constitution, there is freedom of religion. But so the mikvahs are unhygienic. And we all know that according to the law of the land, you go to freedom of religion. But that was never the case. And all religions were persecuted. It was very difficult to get luavim, matzah, etc., svarim. And rabbanim were trying to leave. Everyone was trying to leave. In a situation like that, you want to get out. The only exception, by the way, was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't leave until he was thrown out in 1927. First they wanted to actually execute him, but there was a big protest, and the Lubavitch believed in staying. They have the same philosophy today. You remain there, you stay there. And I'm told that even when the Iron Curtain fell, there were still a couple families that were left who were still Shomer Shabbos. But most, and all the other rabbis, the Chafetz Chaim and the rest said, this is a mistake. You have to get out. Part of my family was in Russia. And they, when the Iron Curtain fell, and once again we reconnected, they were all intermarried, non-religious. I mean, I don't want to criticize the decision of Lubavitch Rebbe, but if you look, it didn't really end well for those Jews who remained. And that's why all the other Hasidic Rebbes and all the other rabbis says, you have to get out of this country. You cannot remain in communist Russia. And whenever you have a situation like this, you have a problem, what's the job of the rabbi? We had this during the years of the Holocaust also. Is the rabbi supposed to remain with the flock? I mean, there are Jews there. They need Torah education. They need shul, etc. Or is the rabbi, does it reach a point where the rabbi is like everyone else and he has to look out for his own family? And again, I'm not here to criticize anyone or anything like that. I'm just saying it's an issue. It's a problem. You had the issue. We know of rabbis in Germany, like the rabbi of Hamburg, Karlbach. He stayed with his flock to the end. Leo Beck and others said that, no, it's time to leave. Every man for themselves. And there were rabbis in the Soviet Union that refused to leave their communities. Many of them ended up in Siberia, you know, and that was the end of them. But there were those who left. Rav Moshe acknowledged this. When he later on, when he came to the United States, he actually, it's reported that he was worried that people would look down on him that he left his community. But according to the way he told it, when it reached the point that he could not give his, I think it's Rav David Feinstein, I don't know if Reuven was alive then, but he couldn't educate his children in Torah, for himself, he said he could have stayed. But when he couldn't educate his children in Torah, then, you know, you go before others. Your family, we say, Aniya Ircha, the poor of your community goes before that poor. Your family obviously has to go before the others. So if he can't raise his own children in a Torah way, then it was time to leave. And actually, when it came to Russia, the rabbis had an easier time getting out than anyone else. In those days, it was still possible to get out, but you needed a visa to go somewhere. And the average person can't get into the United States. You know, other countries, the doors are closed. But if you're a rabbi and the community is going to hire you, you can get out. And I mean, some actually got out illegally. They crossed the border into Poland. But you could also get out legally in many circumstances. Rav Moshe gets an exit visa in 36. Had he not come out, his name would be lost to history, like so many others. And when he comes to America, Hapardes, the rabbinic journal, announces him. You know, they recognize he's one of the rabbis in Russia. There weren't that many of, you know, important stature. But had he not got out, he would have been another one of the rabbis that people like me would know about that never made it out. So we're very fortunate, obviously, he got out. So how did he get out? Well, he had sisters in America, two sisters. And through their congressman, they were able to speak to this man named William Edgars Borah. He was a Republican from Idaho. Since 32, he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And he had a very good relationship with the Soviet ambassador. And through the Soviet ambassador, and he had a letter of invitation to become a rabbi in Toledo, Ohio, he was able to be let out. He only stays in Toledo, Ohio a short time, a couple weeks, if that, to fulfill his obligation to be the rabbi there. And later he worked in a new yeshiva that was established in Cleveland. That didn't work out. And then he was, according to the biography of his sons and son-in-law that appears at the beginning of one of the last volumes of the Iris Moshe, the first posthumously published one, he was offered jobs at both Yeshiva College, Yeshiva Rebbe Elchanan, and Tar Vadas. And he turned them both down because he says he doesn't want to be at an institution that the Balabatim control. He wants to be at a yeshiva where the Rosh Yeshivas control. So he did not go there. I think in retrospect, it's actually, we can say it's precisely those institutions that are controlled by laity boards that are the best ones. Because if you look at yeshivas that are family owned and run by Rosh Yeshiva, it's a Yerusha. It goes to sons and sons-in-law, and it could often happen that the children who inherit it are not at the level, but they just get it because they own it. If you have an institution like, you know, Yeshivas Rebbe Elchanan, where it's a community institution run by a board, they're going to look for the best. And we have examples. I don't need to mention names. But we have examples today of yeshivas that are a pale shadow of what they used to be, precisely because they're not looking for the best faculty. They're looking to give the son-in-law a position. But in any event, Rav Moshe did not want that sort of yeshiva. And he soon accepted a position at a place called Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim, MTJ, on the Lower East Side, where he would remain the rest of his life. Rabbi Joseph Adler, who was the head of this, was a cousin of Rav Moshe's wife, and he was in charge of the lower school, elementary, and he asked Rav Moshe to be, high school, I should say, and he asked Rav Moshe to be Rosh Yeshiva for the older guys. They wanted to have a base medrash program and a smicha program. Rabbi Adler, shortly after that, drowns, swimming off the beach in Far Rockaway, and Rav Moshe becomes then the sole Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Adler's son, by the way, his name was Ramaris Adler. I don't know if this name means anything to you. He was one of the three people who wrote the responsum for the conservative movement permitting driving to shul on Shabbos. So this gives you the sense of the Orthodox community in those days, where the best and the brightest were moving into the conservative world. In fact, Rav Moshe would later write a number of responses. We'll talk about some of them if you have time, dealing with the conservative movement, and it's very interesting. Adler, by the way, was later shot in a synagogue in Southfield, Michigan, during a bar mitzvah by a deranged congregant. And there's a whole book about this called Murder in the Synagogue, a book about this. That title of that book is a play on T.S. Eliot's, is a play on the play by T.S. Eliot, Murder in the Cathedral. Remember the assassination of Archbishop Becket when King Henry said, "What, will anyone rid me of this troublesome priest?" That's in the 12th century. The other signers, by the way, were Jacob Agus, Talmud Muvak of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, then goes to Boston, you know, they thought he'd be one of the great new American Orthodox rabbis. He leaves Orthodoxy and goes into the conservative movement and later becomes a great follower of Mordechai Kaplan. That's his brother, Irving Agus, if anyone went to IU, you might remember him. He was a professor of Jewish history. And the last signer is named Theodore Friedman, also came from an Orthodox home. As Rosh Yeshiva in MTJ, Rav Moshe spends his time in Torah study. And that's what he thought his greatest achievement was in his Torah writings. There's, I think, 18 volumes or so. They're still coming out. Dibros Moshe, his commentaries on Talmud. And that's his major work in yeshiva, every Rosh Yeshiva. Yet it has to be said that the Sefer never caught on. He might have regarded it as his greatest achievement, but the Jewish people did not. I've never seen people study it. You go to a typical base medrash you generally do not see it. If you see it, it's not a sefer that people generally use. It doesn't even rank in the second or third popularity in terms of works that people study on the Talmud. Now, I'm not speaking of a qualitative, obviously. I'm sure it's full of gaonos. It's not for me to say that. I'm just speaking sociologically that the tshuvot, which is what made Rav Moshe's reputation, he became the great poseg, even though he wanted his focus to be on giving shiurim. He became the great posek, which were reprinted numerous times in the chidushim, were basically ignored in the yeshiva world. And tied in with this, although he was a Rosh Yeshiva, he never became like one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, like when you think of them, Rav Shimon Shkop, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Meitshiter, Rav Chaim Telzer, Rav Baruch Bei Leibowitz, etc. They're remembered as the great Rosh Yeshiva, and people came from all over the world to study there. People would go to Punavej, to Mir, to Telz, to Lakewood. You didn't have people coming from all over the world to study in MTJ. It remained really a small yeshiva. And it's interesting. It's like, why? Why did, if you have this great person, Rav Moshe Feinstein, why is that his yeshiva never took off? And is it because he wasn't regarded as a Rosh Yeshiva, he was regarded as a posek, they didn't come, and that's why he wasn't regarded? It's hard to know, but we do know that he was the greatest posek of his generation, not the greatest Rosh Yeshiva. And I asked two different scholars of this, one who works on the Art Scroll Talmud, very learned fellow, another big rabbi, why that is the case. What is it about the Dibros Moshe? And they both independently gave me the same reasons, that the Chidushim, first of all, are not classic brisker approach that they like in the yeshiva world today, and also they're very long and cumbersome. I mean, if you're not going to be brisker, you want it more like the Aruch HaNer or the Netziv's commentary, the Sfas Emes, you know, shorter things. And then Rav Moshe goes on, it's very difficult, you have to follow it. It doesn't fit in with the current model of yeshiva learning. Also, I have to say that, Sfarim generally don't take on. Every Rosh Yeshiva writes Sfarim. How many Sfarim really catch on in terms of Chidushim? Every generation, maybe one. Think of every Rosh Yeshiva writes their Chidushim. But generally, who studies them? When I was in Yeshiva, there was only one work from a contemporary Rosh Yeshiva that people studied. It was Rav Gusman's work. But all the Rosh Yeshiva wrote Chidushim. But who, you know, the library, anytime I study a modern work, that means I have to take one of the classic works and push them aside. And it's only a few of them in a century, really, that will become standard works. Now, this is very important, because had Rav Moshe not become the great posek and only written his Chidushim, we wouldn't be having this talk today. We wouldn't remember him, because he'd be like many other Rosh Yeshiva. By the same token, many people publish volumes of Psak, but in every century, only a few catch on. You go through the centuries, the 19th century, you know, Ritzel Chorin Spector, the Chassam Sofer, the 18th century, the Noda Bihur, I mean, Yaakov Hemdin, the Chacham Tzvi, you go down the list, only a few. Most of the works, you can see them on HebrewBooks.org, but only historians or people like me study them. And that's how we have to turn to the Igros Moshe, because when it comes to his Psakim, not only are his works the classics for the 20th century, as long as people study Responsa, they will study the Igros Moshe. Without question, the most important American responsa ever, and in the post-war years, perhaps the most influential in the world. So let's talk about that. The first volume appears in 1959, and people were waiting for this because already he was known as a great posek in the New York area, and they wanted his responsa. And people, and Rav Moshe soon assumed a reputation as a posek that could deal with any matter. And that was a correct impression. In the introduction of the first volume, he says something incredible. He says that a real posek has to answer every question that comes to him. He can't say, you know, I'm not great enough, go to someone else. He has to answer everything. This is two elements. First of all, he has to answer everything. Rav Moshe, the idea that we have today, I think, that some people, there are posek in this area, but not in that area, that's for someone like Rav Moshe, that's like for the minor leagues. A great posek doesn't say, well, I'm not an expert on mikvot or on Erevin. You have to ask someone else. If you're a posek, and that's how, by the way, in Europe, if you're a Rav of a city, you answered all the questions that came to you there. So that's very traditional, what Rav Moshe says there. What's not traditional is the other aspect, where he says that you have to fearlessly answer all the questions and everything. And Rav Moshe never asks anyone else. He gives his opinion. And yet, it's very common to see post-scheme to say things like, well, this is my opinion, but don't rely on me. I'm not great enough, ask someone else. Not saying I don't know anything about the area like we have today, ask these other people, but say I'm not great enough. That's a very common thing. I think it's very untraditional for Rav Moshe to speak like that. A posek has to fearlessly answer every question. Rav Yaakov Weinberg often said, well, don't rely on me, I'm not great enough, and many other posekim, but not Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe says actually it's forbidden to send to someone else. If they ask you, you have to answer. So getting back to Rav Moshe, as I said, he was prepared to deal with all the issues. Apparently, he didn't think of the consequences. What do I mean by saying he didn't think of the consequences? We all know many examples of posekim who will say things privately but won't say things publicly. They don't want to get in trouble. And Rav Moshe will see God in a lot of trouble. And, it does tell us, the Gemara tells us, based on the pasuk, Go Saguru, you're not supposed to be afraid. You're supposed to issue your pasuk. But that's easier said than done. Because, unfortunately, there are people in this world that will literally kill, I won't say literally kill you, it was figuratively kill you, but do everything almost to kill you, kill your reputation, if a posek says something that doesn't fit in with the standard approach or something. And there are many, many posekim. I've been told personally by posekim, I'm telling you this, but don't repeat it in my name, just say that you were told by a posek, which of course it could be problematic. This is when I worked at Brandeis, because then people could challenge you and say, well, who said it? And if I don't reveal it, maybe I'm making it up. Like we spoke about the other day, the Gemara gives, apparently, at least according to one opinion, you can actually do that sometimes. But Rav Moshe writes down everything. He's not afraid, it seems. And he says that you can even disagree with medieval authorities, the Rishonim. The Man El Igros goes crazy about this. He says this shows Rav Moshe's chutzpah. He says that you can disagree with the Rishonim. But Rav Moshe says you can if you are sure of your answers. The only thing you can't disagree with is the Shulchan Aruch and the commentaries. That is, if there's an accepted position found in the Shulchan Aruch, we do not disagree with that because that's already been accepted. Now, in understanding how Rav Moshe became so famous, by the mid-1950s, he's regarded as the greatest posek in America, we should bear in mind what Rav Avram Shapiro, the great chief rabbi of Israel, Rosh Hashiva of America's Arav, stated. He said that it's no accident that the poskim who are accepted by Kol Yisrael are known as mekilim, lenient poskim. That doesn't mean they're always lenient. Only, I think, in the conservative movement, you can assume, you know ahead of time what the psak is going to be. Every one of our great poskim, even the most lenient ones, and we'll see with Rav Moshe, have certain stringencies. You can't predict it, but there's a tendency. And the reason is because, if the masses are not going to ask questions, if you're always getting an answer you don't like, you're not going to go to these posek. But if a posek has a reputation of giving, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with asking a posek. Everyone asks, you want a certain answer. I mean, that's the whole point of asking. If you don't get it, you're supposed to be bound. You listen to what he says, but that doesn't, or maybe she says, if we're reaching that era. But that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with hoping for an answer. Of course you hope for a leniency, especially if it's a case, a serious case. That's nothing wrong with that at all. And I don't even think there's anything wrong with going to a post-seg who's known that in this area, you know, he's an expert in this area and he's liberal. As long as you bind yourself to follow the PSOC, unless he tells you that this is my PSOC because I can't find a leniency, but you can ask, you know, some post-seg would say you can ask someone else. And Ramosha got a reputation as generally a lenient post-seg, just like a Ribitz Ochon inspector. You know, if you wanted a Naguna case, you knew you went to a Ribitz Ochon inspector and almost always he could find a way out of it. Then it repeats again and again. Now, we're going to see with Ramosha, when it comes to reform, he's anything but lenient in at least one area, but from another perspective, he is very lenient. And Ramosha Feinstein actually gave an interview to the New York Times. They wrote an article on responsa literature, and they asked him, how does one become an important halachic authority? And obviously, he's thinking about himself, and he says, people ask questions. If they like the answers, they ask more questions. That's exactly how, because we choose the poskim. This isn't like the Catholic Church where, you know, the bishops are chosen by the Pope and even your local parish priest is chosen. We make the poskim because we have faith in them, and not just in their knowledge, we also have faith in their honesty, in their tzidkus, etc. So that's the first reason Ramosha becomes an important posek. Another point is that he comes from Lithuania, and most Lithuanians were not interested in Psak. They're interested just in Mishiurim, and so he was able to fill a void. But that don't think that people followed Ramosha consistently. You often hear people say that you should follow a posek consistently. Ramosha Feinstein is relied upon for all sorts of things. The height of the mechitza, shaving, chol moed. I'm not going to say chol of Yisrael, that's what people say, because people ate chol of stam before Ramosha Feinstein. Incidentally, Ramosha Feinstein held that the milk that's you get from the supermarket is chol of Yisrael, because the government watches it, is Chol of Yisrael. He called it Chol of Companies, he calls it. And there's this idea that, you know, when I was, we went, the first summer we went to Budapest, so, you know, I wanted to know about the milk. Could we drink the milk? I actually asked a Chabad rabbi, I said, yes, the milk is all fine, even though they don't drink it. So I went into the little store there, there's a kosher store, because they don't drink Chol of Yisrael, they're very makpid on this. And I asked the guy for some milk, so he gave me, because we were traveling and I wanted to have some milk in the bus, and he showed me some milk from France, Chol of Yisrael, very expensive. I said, no, regular milk. You know, I could go anywhere. I wanted to give him some money. He says, we only drink Chol of Yisrael. He says, why don't you? I said, well, you know, we rely on Ramosha. And he says, Ramosha only gave that heter for the weak American Jews. That's what he said. But that's not true. His own family didn't keep Chol of Yisrael. In any event, in the first volume, Vigor Smosha, for instance, he has a tshuva saying that you can't use liquid soap on Shabbos. Now, I've never met anyone who holds this. The Rav strongly disagreed with this. I even asked a prominent member of his family, who remain nameless right now, but I can tell later, what did Ramosha do for hygiene and everything? And his answer was, he doesn't know. By saying he doesn't know, that means he doesn't even follow the Psak, because otherwise he'd tell me what he did. And he says, it's in Ramosha's own family they didn't hold of this. Why didn't this Psak ever catch on? Ramosha himself notes that people were already accustomed to using liquid soap, but it's one thing to change a stringent practice to a lenient practice, but people are not going to change a lenient one to a strict one. But it's interesting to ask, you know, other Talmidim of Rav Moshe, did anyone follow this? Why not? Now, whether it's okay to follow a posek some of the time, not all the time, it's an interesting question. We don't have time to deal with it now. I'll just tell you, in America, we all eat the OU. That means we all follow the Psakim, including the Kuhls, the Refershal Schechter. And as far as I know, none of us follow some of his extreme chumras. So, I mean, it's very hard to say that I don't even think he drinks milk, but because he has a whole sheet. It's very hard to say you always have to follow a posek all the time, especially if it's not dealing with a posek mufak. I mean, and certainly, like if Schechter comes to my shul like every other month, you know, I've asked him lots of questions. He asks questions. That doesn't mean that because I asked him a question on Pesach, do I do this? Does that mean that from now on, every single psak he ever gave, I have to? Then it would make no sense. In my shul, we have big Talmid Chachamim who come to shul, and, you know, you have a question. You go up and ask him the question. I had a big shaila in Israel a couple summers ago when I was at the hotel, the David Citadel, Rabbi Lau was there. So I asked Rabbi Lau the question. Does that mean that now every time I have a question, I have to call up Rabbi Lau? No, I don't think anyone has ever said that. For another example of a chumrah of Ramosha that never caught on is Shabbos clocks. Do you know that Ramosha prohibited Shabbos clocks for everything but lights? And he actually thought lights also should not be allowed, but he said it's already become accustomed. And he notes that the Orthodox world does it. Okay, before looking at Ramosha's decision, let me mention briefly something about his influence, because his influence today is not what it was at the time of his death. And let me give two examples to illustrate this. And that's the way it should be, by the way. You know, new poskim, a new era, new rabbis. But just two easy examples. Rav Moshe was very opposed to an Erev in Brooklyn. I mean, he also opposed the Manhattan Erev. But there he says, well, if people want to rely on it, there's what to rely. But with Brooklyn, he was very strongly opposed to it. And during his lifetime, the movement for a Flatbush Erev, Borough Park Erev, really never caught on. By 10 years after his death, you know, today you have an Erev, and you have the people who hold of it, the people who don't. But during his lifetime, you didn't really have that. That's one example of the waning influence. And also, he has a famous responsum to Rabbi Teitz. I went to Rabbi Teitz's yeshiva. Rabbi Teitz wanted to put out, like, kosher schnapps, kosher whiskey, without any, you know, they used to put a little bit of wine in it. I don't know. It doesn't deal with the sherry casks, but that's the same issue with it. And the story is that, you know, he was going to be a big company and you can make a lot of money on this and help the yeshiva. I think they were going to call it Mayim Chaim. That's what I was told. I don't know if it's true. In any event, Rav Moshe Feinstein issues a ruling that it doesn't matter that there's little bits of a blended whiskey that non-Jewish wine is added, non-kosher wine is added, because it's butl. And with wine, by the way, it's not butl in 60, it's butl in 6. And once that psak was given, and Rabbi Teitz wrote back to him, that became the standard psak. About 10 years after Ramosha's death, all of a sudden, now people start talking. The OU even put this thing out that we shouldn't rely on Ramosha anymore. I know the person in Ramosha's family was very upset. He told me that he thinks it's a big chutzpah. Because in the article on it, it says, after going through the whole thing in Jewish Action, they say you should ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Wait a minute, why should I ask my local Orthodox rabbi? If the Posek Gador said it's okay, and I don't know what the situation is in Canada. I know they tried it in certain shuls, and one rabbi said to me, when people said that we don't want to drink this anymore unless it has a shkach, he said, okay, you can give it to me. But in my shul, we still have the regular ones. The Hasidim never went along with it, because if you saw your Rebbe drinking the schnapps, you know, how are you going to say it's no good? I don't know what the situation in Canada is, if they require. I think the London Basin has recently said that they'll require hashgacha on it. But, I mean, Ramosha says it's better. He says, a baal nefesh, it's better. But technically, it's 100%. And my sense in America is that some shuls still have all them, some shuls not. I know of one shul, they said they tried getting rid of it, but the people wouldn't accept it, so now they have it. So I don't know what they do with the kiddush clubs at the various shuls here, if they require. But the fact that Ramosha's decision was not enough 10 years after his death, that shows that, you know, okay, let me now speak about a couple of his significant rulings so we get a sense of the man. Now, by the way, his growing importance coincided with something else of interest, the usurpation of authority in the American rabbinate, the transference of authority from the local Rav to the Rosh Yeshiva. And today, I mean, anytime there's a question, who do you ask? There are no real pulpit rabbis who are considered great post-scheme that everyone asks. They go to the Rosh Yeshiva, they go to Rav Schechter or Wilg or any else. That's not how it used to be. It used to be that all the great post-scheme were communal rabbanim, including the Netziv. He was also the Rav of Volozhin. This changes after you know, people come to America, and now the transference of authority is only among the Rosh Yeshiva, and that's going to have enormous impact, because the Rosh Yeshiva are not dealing with the masses when they give psak. They're not dealing with average people. They're in a different world. But we see this clearly. The beginnings of this is found in this document I showed here. This is a famous document in which the great rabbis of America declare that it's forbidden to be a member of an interdenominational organization. Like in America, you have the Board of Rabbis. I'm sure you have things up here. And it's all the great, you know, Haredi rabbis sign it. The only one on this list who's a posek is Rav Moshe Feinstein. And this also solidified himself. He's the posek, really, of the Lithuanian world. Actually, you have two YU people on this, Rav David Lifshitz and Rabbi Zaks, the son of the Chavetz Chaim, who taught at YU. He was the bochein there. So you can't have any interdenominational things with the Synagogue Council of America, boards of rabbis, etc. There is a name, an important name that's missing here, of course, Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rav Moshe is said to have mentioned that Normally, we have a principle, shtika koda adamya, that silence equals acquiescence. But he says, in this case, I think not. And he was right, that Rav Soloveitchik, he did not see any halachic prohibition. He apparently had no liking for the New York Board of Rabbis, interdenominational rabbis. He didn't see an value for that, but he did say there's no prohibition. But the Synagogue Council of America, he thought that that was important because it was Jewish organizations, Reform, Orthodox, not dealing with religious matters, dealing with anti-Semitism, things like that. And he gave his backing to it. Rabbi Wurzberger, who I think was rabbi here, wasn't he, Wurzberger, in Toronto? He was very involved in this sort of thing, and he was very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Also, another important name missing, who was the last of the great rabbonim, who was actually a pulpit rabbi in America, Rav Eliezer Silver. He didn't sign it. And the reason he didn't sign it is because he said, this is a document directed against the YU graduates who are serving on these boards, and they're the Talmidim of the Rav. If their Rebbe says it's okay, who are you to sign something, say it's not okay? And also, he didn't like the usurpation of authority from the local Rav. This document is the beginning of what we call Das Torah in America, where they, through the charismatic authority of the great rabbis, they say you can't do this, without giving reasons, halachic reasons. Together with Ramosha's growing reputation, there was accompanied by some very lenient rulings, even radical, especially in the area of Evin Ezer. In fact, his great liberality in this area is confronted by a great conservatism as well, relating to the non-Orthodox, but I think in one example, at least, you can say that what appears on the outside to be very conservative is really very liberal. In fact, perhaps the most influential psak of the 20th century. I don't have time to go into his attitude to reform or conservative in any detail. Suffice it to say, he was entirely negative. He had no patience for them. He regards them as heretics, no more, no less. He distinguishes, though, between rabbis who are believers who work in conservative shuls. And there used to be many who did that to make a living. They're wrong, but they're still, you know, they're Jews. They're not heretics or anything. They're just chazanim and rabbis. That he regards them as very differently. They're wrong, but they're not out of the fold. But as for the believers, the true believers in conservative reform, they're not part of religious Jewry. He even says that you can't answer amen to their bracha, which itself is a big chiddush, and he was criticized for this because a reformed Jew still has an obligation to make a bracha. I mean, it's still halacha. Even if he doesn't believe in it, it's halacha. But Ramosha held that. Now, one of his most famous rulings, repeated in a number of places, relates to civil marriage and then later reform marriage. There's probably been more written about this topic than any topic ever in halacha in the recent century. Because, look, if a civil marriage is a halachically binding marriage, then we have a real problem. Because all the people who are civilly married, none of them get gets, and then they remarry and have children. The children are all mamzerim. The Jewish people were split. Enormously difficult. Well, why should civil marriage be binding halachically? Well, for the simple reason that for a man and woman to be bound together, you don't need a chuppah, you don't need a party, you don't need the brachos. All you need is a man in front of two witnesses to give an object of value and say, with this you are betrothed, and with that you need a get. And really, the Gemara says, though, there's other way you can betroth a woman. There's more than one way. Another way is if you live with her. If you live with her publicly, that's regarded as betrothal, which needs a get. It's the same thing as marriage. It's adultery and mamzeris if you don't separate without a get. So when you have people who are civilly married and are living publicly together as man and wife, how could you say they're not married, requiring a get? And this was the opinion of Rav Henkin, that this is a valid marriage. I mean, the Gemara says that you're Mekadesh Ta'icha, Bekesef, Beshtar, Bavia. The third one means living together publicly. Shtar, by the way, does not mean a ketubah. Shtar means there's a special document that would write, it has to be Lashma that you give. It actually would not be a bad idea if we went back and did the shtar. I'll tell you why, because everyone learns in school, because it has to be written Lashma. Everyone learns in school that you learn Kedushin, you Mekadesh Ta'icha with a pruta. And there always are cases, the responsa literature are full of what we call kiddushei schok. Every year in summer camp, there's a case like this, where a guy just gives something to a girl and says, Hare Mekadeshali. And then you have a real problem. And it's not so simple to say, just give a get, because then she can't marry a Kohen. We had a case like this when I was in high school at a basketball game, where a guy would betroth the girl with the bottle cap, and Rabbi Teitzer ruled it wasn't worth a pruta. But the responsa literature are full of what they call kiddushei schok, where they think it's a big joke. You know, a 10th grader, 9th grader at a basketball game or something does that. If it was a shtar, then they can never do that. But in any event, And incidentally, in Yemen, they never will be betrothed with rings. Where the rings come from, that's a different issue. Any object of value. Rav Moshe, however, thought, and we don't have time to go into the arguments in any detail, but he thought that the marriage is not binding because if they intend to get civilly married, there's no religious component, they don't want a Jewish marriage, we have no reason to assume that it's not, as to use the Talmudic term, living immorally, bilatznut. And Rav Moshe is not the first one to say this. Other people said also you don't need to get. That's not what I say the most important decision, though. The most important one, this then branched out into reform marriage. Rav Moshe is the first one to say that a reform marriage, and later conservative marriages, some of them, you'd have to check that, which marriage in particular, but a reform marriage, Rav Moshe says, without even looking, you can assume a reform marriage is no good. He's the first one to say that. This is a big problem, because with a reform marriage, they clearly do want to be married Jewishly, and you know, they actually go, they're reformed, so they go to a reform rabbi. And, Rav Moshe says, they don't even give a ring. Rabbi Chaya Kovheimer says, what do you mean they don't give a ring? Of course they give a ring. And it appears to go against the Chasam Sofer. How could you say a reform marriage is not a valid marriage? But again, Rav Moshe, and had Rav Moshe's opinion not been this way, and had we not accepted it, just think what this means. All these people getting divorced, they don't get gets. In the reform movement, they say you don't need a get. We couldn't have a Kiruv movement without this because you'd have half the people would be regarded as illegitimate. We wouldn't be one people anymore in that respect. So it's this psak, which you, on the one hand might seem like a big chumrah, saying that reformed people, they've been living 30 years, you're saying they're, quote, living in sin, they're not married, so that could be seen as a great chumrah. But on the other hand, it's the greatest kula because it allows the Jewish people to stay together. Now my sense is, I've spoken to rabbis, that we rely on Rav Moshe. If you can't get a get, we try to get a get, you rely on him. But if you have a family that, let's say, becomes Balei Tshuva, I can tell you that in the modern Orthodox shuls, I asked a person in the RCA, they never say to them, get remarried halachically. We assume Rav Henkin's correct. Chabad, I was told, does try to do that. But I know plenty of people who became religious later in life, and they were never told by the rabbi that they have to remarry. If they were civil, maybe they would. But we go to what time? Okay, so Rav Moshe was the first posek to state that without hesitation. The other great leniency which shook the Orthodox world is artificial insemination. Rav Moshe ruled, halacha l'maisa, that if a woman who's married cannot get pregnant, she can be artificially inseminated. She can't be inseminated by a Jewish man because that would create problems with her children. They marry someone else, they could be their brother. But if it's a Jewish woman, we're not, and it's a non-Jewish father, there's no halachic connection, and therefore Rav Moshe ruled that you can get married, artificially inseminated. Now the outcry to this was unbelievable. If you have a problem reading Nazi racial theory, you're going to have a problem reading some of the responses, because all the attacks on Rav Moshe were like, we're a holy people, you're bringing in the non-Jewish blood with all the negative characteristics, all that sort of thing. The Baba Vareb Rebbe put a chayrim on anyone who follows this. The Satmar Rebbe went crazy over this. I mean, this was an unbelievable, but Rav Moshe didn't back down. The most he would do would say in one of the later letters, don't rely on me, let the other rabbi look at it and say if they agree. But from a halachic standpoint, he said there's no adultery. Adultery has to have a physical connection. The Satmar Rebbe said it's a real adultery. And he was attacked by one person who wrote a letter saying, how could you say this, on and on. And Rav Moshe says, you're being influenced by the outside world. I'm not. I'm just looking at the Torah sources. What I think Rav Moshe means by this is that this person was saying, you can assume he's saying, based on Rav Moshe's response, that this is disgusting. Well, from Rav Moshe's standpoint, why is it disgusting? If the halacha allows it, then it's an emergency situation. As he said, this was a real emergency situation. Then in this case, it's not disgusting. It's a heter, not for everyone. In this case, I think today now it's very common to follow Rav Moshe's psak in that area. Because from a standpoint of pure halacha, it really is irrefutable, I believe. You know, Rabbi Breisch, who was a great posting in Switzerland, the Chagas Yaakov, said that we can't do this because the Catholics have condemned it. The Nismil make a chil Hashem. But I mean, this is not really halachic argumentation. Just a couple other things, because we only have 5 minutes. There's so many tshuvot we could discuss. We could spend hours. I just want to mention one unfortunate tshuva, put unfortunate in quotes. I say unfortunate because of its results, but Reb Moshe was an Ish Emes, a man of truth, so he had to conclude this. And it's unfair to criticize him for concluding this, but it is unfortunate. I refer to smoking. Reb Moshe consistently said that you cannot forbid smoking. Even though it's unhealthy and you can't smoke in yeshiva and everything, and I know people would say, Rav Tenor says if he was alive today, he would certainly ban it because the medical science is so clear. Rav Tenor actually thinks that smoking, he says, it's worse to smoke than to eat pig. But again, I don't know if we want to go there, because if smoking is really so bad, then someone who smokes, I don't think they're allowed to be, and in fact, Rav in Israel ruled this, you can't have him as an aide at a wedding. Do we want to go there where all the friends who smoke, we say you can't be a witness at a wedding? I don't know if we want to go there. But in any event, and I don't think Rav Tenor is necessarily correct, because Rav Moshe's, one of his decisions is after the Surgeon General's warning, maybe both of them. Rav Moshe says we have a principle that if enough people do something, it's sort of, you know, it could be a bad idea, but we can't technically say it's forbidden. And, you know, what about the Shomer Pesayim Hashem is called? What about the slippery slope? Are we going to ban fatty foods? Are you going to say it's forbidden to, you know, go skydiving or something? A lot of things are bad ideas, but to say they're technically forbidden with the implications, which could be, like I said, you don't count someone as a witness, you know, for a wedding or things like that. Rav Moshe didn't want to say it was usser. And therefore, you know, it's unfortunate because today I think all the poskim say it's usser. At least all the poskim in our world, Rav Vadia. But you go to Israel, lots of people smoke. It's terrible. But what if this is Rav Moshe's decision? He was criticized by, I saw a conservative rabbi wrote a piece criticizing Rav Moshe. He said if Rav Moshe ruled it's usser, he would have saved many lives. Basically, what he wants Rav Moshe to do is, for social engineering, distort the halacha as he sees it. I don't think a poskim can do that. Second of all, I don't think this rabbi is right. I mean, if Rav Moshe said it, they'd listen. Who was the greatest posek in 10 years ago? The Das Torah in the Lithuanian world had much more of a... he had Das Torah in the Lithuanian world. Rav Moshe had Psak. He didn't have Das Torah. Rav Yoshev. Rav Yoshev's word was the end of everything in Israel. Whatever he said for the Haredim, supposedly they listened. And yet Rav Yoshev came out, and this isn't like something you could say it's a legend. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. He said explicitly, without any ifs, ands, or buts, that the modern shadels... you know, the long shadels, the fancy shadels, all those, absolutely forbidden, cannot be worn. And yet, I go to Flatbush, I go to Borough Park, I haven't seen any difference. It seems that, so who says that the people listen? Do you think Rav Moshe, if you're addicted to smoking, the fact that Rav Moshe said it's usher, you think they're going to listen? No, they'll find a terrarium, they'll find other reasons for it. And I think the social engineering point is an important one. You can't ask Rav Moshe to give a wrong decision because of social engineering. And the final example, which is perhaps disappointing, is his tshuva on homosexuality. But again, he's writing in a different era. He really didn't understand that there are people who have this attraction. He sees it all, a bunch of hedonists, people who want to rebel against God. And even today, the Haredi world doesn't cite this tshuva because it's so wrong in the mitzvos, although this was a common belief that, you know, the idea of a homosexual identity, that's a relatively recent thing. Most people assume that these are just people trying to, you know, try out all the pleasures in the world, that sort of thing. So, it's from our standpoint, it's difficult to read it, but it makes sense in that era. Let me conclude by saying that Rav Moshe was really a towering figure. We haven't even, not even a regular, we haven't even begun to touch his greatness in so many ways. A book just came out in Hebrew, like some 400 pages, which also only begins to touch his greatness. And his absence is really apparent today. He was a man of the people. You didn't have to go through the handlers to reach him like today. His phone number was always in the phone book. He lived among the masses, the Hamonam. Today, the people giving Pesach today live in the yeshiva world among Talmidei Chachamim. Anything they say, the people will listen to. They don't live among, Moshe lived on the Lower East Side. He lived among regular people. He's answering questions to Berkeley, to Lansing, Michigan, to Canton, Ohio. You know, Halacha has a whole system here. Better that they be unwitting sinners than not. If they're not going to listen to what you're going to say, you know, then tell him this. Rav Moshe had to deal with this dialectic all the time. If you ask a posek in Bnei Brak today, the whole concept of, you know, they might not listen to what you're going to say, so say, you know, you can't say it, they'll listen to whatever you say. In fact, they want the more chumras. They want it. Rav Moshe was still dealing with the old way of Pesach, where there's this balancing act between what the posek would prefer, but what the people would listen to. And that's a very different situation than we have today. He wasn't writing for, you know, yeshiva people, Haredi worlds. You know, just like there's a mitzvah to say what they'll listen to, there's a mitzvah not to say what they won't listen to. These are concepts which Poskim today don't really have to deal with because they're not dealing with the masses. Rav Moshe was dealing with the masses, and really he's the last Posek of that genre in the Ashkenazic world. We don't have them today. You have them in the Sephardic world, definitely. But in the Ashkenazic world, all the Poskim are really coming out of a very different world than Rav Moshe. And I see my time is already here. I'm sorry if I spoke too quickly. I was watching the clock. You know, when you're having fun, time goes fast. But we don't have time for questions, unfortunately. But thank you all.